welcome to the Dialogue Journal podcast, where we bring you thought-provoking discussions and readings that explore the rich and complex world of Mormon thought. I'm your host, Taylor Petrie, editor of Dialogue, the Journal of Mormon Thought. Today's episode features a unique presentation, Lester Bush's journey as seen by his wife, Yvonne. This personal reflection, written by Yvonne Bush, was presented on June 9th, 2023, at a session of the Mormon History Association Conference, honoring the 50th anniversary of Lester Bush's groundbreaking article, Mormonism's Negro Doctrine and Historical Overview. The paper is read by Kim Bush, Yvonne and Lester's daughter, offering a moving perspective on how Lester's work shaped not only the broader church, but also their family's journey. Yvonne Bush provides an intimate lens into the life of a man whose scholarship changed the course of Mormon history. Her account reminds us that behind every scholarly contribution are the personal and familial sacrifices that make such work possible. Before we begin, please note that the views expressed in this episode represent those of the author and not necessarily those of Dialogue Journal, the Mormon History Association, or The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This paper is also included in the fall 2024 issue of Dialogue, part of a special roundtable commemorating the 50th anniversary of Lester Bush's landmark publication. If you haven't already, we encourage you to read the issue at dialoguejournal.com. As we reflect on the past, we also look ahead to future conversations. The Mormon History Association invites you to its 60th anniversary conference to be held June 5th to 8th, 2025 in Ogden, Utah. This year's theme, Junctions and Communities, explores how restoration traditions intersect with broader histories and cultures. Ogden, often called Junction City, provides the perfect backdrop for such discussions, with its rich history of indigenous trade, railroad development, and waves of migration. Additionally, don't miss MHA's Latter-day Histories lecture series, which features cutting-edge Mormon history research. Upcoming lectures include Jason Palmer on Peruvian Mormon Mujeristas, moderated by Elise Boxter, on January 9, 2025, and Amiche Okafor discussing Mormonism in Africa, an Indigenous Perspective, moderated by Dima Hulbert, on March 6, 2025. Proceeds from the lecture series support live streaming and recording of the annual conference, ensuring accessibility for members and the general public. And now, without further ado, here is Kim Bush reading Lester Bush's Journey as Seen by His Wife, Yvonne.
Lester Bush's Journey as Seen by His Wife, Yvonne. So those of you who have paid attention along the way know quite a bit about Lester's 1973 article, particularly because of the follow-up article he published in the Journal of Mormon History in 1999 that gave a detailed account of how he did it. But as you've heard from Greg, and unfortunately, hopefully Darius, in some form later today, additional details have continued to come forward. Since I was often the only person in the room, I offer my reminiscences and reflections. Lester and I started dating when I was 18. He was in his second year of medical school, and I was in high school. Think about that one for a second. For some reason, I still don't have any idea why he decided that I was going to be a girlfriend. And even though I was young and completely clueless, but I knew even at 18 that he was going to be my partner. He was the only person in my life up to that point who would ever ask me, "Are you really as happy as you seem?" He wanted to know who I was. He was kind and gentle. And at that moment, I thought, I trust this person, and I will be with him and devoted to him forever. Boy, I'm really feeling this, and I did not expect this to happen, so just bear with me. He could see deeper. As it came to pass, I also became his project. So he took the summer before I went to BYU to warn me that it was all about getting a partner out there and getting married, and I needed to pursue a more academic approach. I had done well in high school, but nothing spectacular, but I was interested in anything, especially if Lester had something to do with it. He was the one that pointed me to political science, foreign affairs, church ideas, you name it. every topic known to mankind. The blacks he was already super interested in and had already started a file at that point in time. That was 1966. We were married the following year. At that point, there was all this talk about Elijah Abel and the curse of Cain. Lester hadn't sorted out all the Joseph Smith and Brigham Young things yet. It was a big time. We were having church statements coming out, and there was all the intrigue with Hugh B. Brown predicting and the end of the policy. A year after we were married, we went to Salt Lake for Lester's medical internship at an LDS hospital. It was a bit of a rude awakening to start a second year of marriage that way. He was an intern, so his hours were such that we didn't have much time together. Though he was tired and exhausted, he fit every moment he could in the library, in the archives, whatever he could get himself into, talking to people and getting more and more material. I was taking courses at the University of Utah and remember not being very happy with the fact that I was not his project anymore. I was his wife number two, if not number three, and after his research in medicine. When Lester was in Salt Lake City, he read Stephen Taggart's small book on Mormonism and the Negro. Lester could see that his own research to this point was indicative of a more complex narrative. He got in touch with Dialogue at the time and wrote an article in the winter of 1969 that was a commentary on Taggart's book. This was his first published work on the subject. After his internship, Lester spent 3 years in the Navy, being stationed in Virginia Beach and then Cyprus in the Middle East. While we were in Cyprus, he began to type his compilation on blacks in the priesthood. My diary entry from July of 1971 says, "The other day, Lester was reading a Dialogue advertisement that they planned to do a special issue on minority groups. This once again stirred him to write a definitive article on the church and the Negro. I know that this is so important to him. He wants to do something well and authoritative, and he wants to be of some service to the church on this matter and help facilitate some change in policy, hopefully. He also wants to get through with it so he can pursue other matters. I told him that I would support him and help him when I could. But given past experience, he knows or feels that I don't really mean it, and it is only a short-lived promise. So today he asked me to hang in there and help for 6 months. I think this is asking quite a bit, since the baby is due in 3, and there is so much to do beforehand, can you imagine? However, I have given the matter some thought, and I think it would be better for me to do as he says. I think this will result in a stronger emotional and spiritual bond between us when he realizes that I love him enough to help him in every way. It will certainly be a challenge, if only I can avoid the martyr complex." When we were in Cyprus, Lester never stopped. He kept getting letters and information from here and there, from his brother Larry, from every place he could to keep that door open. Those were the 6 months he was hoping I could hang in. The 6 months where he started typing it all up, putting stuff together and chronologically into his compilation. He really hoped his work would help the church move forward. He thought that if he knew and understood that it would be okay, that we would have a better understanding and be able to problem solve things. That was his main thing. He wasn't interested in being polemical or forcing the church to do this or that. He wanted to do work within the system and be able to affect change if that was possible. There is a letter that I came across recently that he wrote to his brother Larry at around the same time. Larry was outraged with what was going on in the church. I didn't see Larry's letter. I was just reading Lester's response. Lester went through each of Larry's concerns. It was really beautiful. He wrote of his belief in the faith of the gospel, that as far as problems with the brethren were concerned, there were good things there, that we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Then he wrote, "To me, operating from within feels much more comfortable. Nobody has ever made a significant impact on the church from without, excepting the U.S. Congress, the Supreme Court, and a handful of assassins." While we were in Cyprus, we were visited by Edwin and Janet Cannon, who were presiding over the Swiss mission that included Cyprus. Janet took keen interest in Lester's work, and Lester presented her with a copy of his 400-page compilation. 400 pages. She, in turn, and with Lester's permission, sent it to Boyd Packard with the hope that it would help move the church forward. In a note to Lester, she said, I will be rather glad to be relieved of the responsibility of personal possession of this treasure. It's a little like owning the Hope Diamond. One's pleasure in gloating over it is always dimmed by the vague fear of disaster. But instead of welcoming a documentary source, unlike the church had ever prepared itself, Elder Packer seemingly tried to evade and delay, if not fully prevent, the publication of the article and dialogue. Since that history was already presented in Lester's 1999 article, I won't dwell on it here. Only to say, I remember as if it was yesterday, Lester returned to Saigon, where we were later stationed, starting right in, recounting the hours he spent with Elder Packer almost before he put his bags down. With a rueful expression and a furrowed brow, he said it went okay. I wasn't kicked out, but curiously, he told me I was a unique duck. Lester took this to mean that Elder Packer didn't know what to think of him or his work, nor that Lester would actually be willing to accept any and all information or insight that Elder Packer or church historians or anyone could provide that would allow Lester's material might be presented. Otherwise, Lester would not back down and would proceed to publication. Suffice to say that although Lester's good intentions were clear, it was my impression that the issue for Elder Packer was that exposure of any kind that might challenge the status quo was unwelcomed, regardless of intentions. In the autumn of 1972, while transitioning from Cyprus to Saigon, and months before his meeting with Elder Packer, Lester had conversations with two editors of Dialogue that resulted in him moving from the compilation to what he called a short historical overview of the Negro Doctrine. Most of the writing was done in Saigon over a period of what he called 4 exhaustive, prayerful months. During all of this, while in Cyprus and Vietnam, he was also very active in the church. He was a group leader of a small LDS group in Nicosia, and then he was the second counselor at the Saigon branch presidency. In Saigon, he aided and abetted the efforts to advance the Vietnamization program in all of the church auxiliaries. There were no Americans higher than second counselor, per the mission president, Bill Bradshaw. While we were there, things opened up. There was a ceasefire, and then with a lot of preparation, missionaries could come in. Preparation and planning was Lester's thing, along with two other American contractors who were his buddies in arms. They had a whole list of things they sent to the mission president that needed to be put in place before the missionaries would be safe and be able to work when they landed. Though the climate was hot and humid, Lester insisted for their health and well-being that they needed to play football with him regularly. The mission president also joined in the games during his visits. While all of this was going on, Lester continued to frantically work on his article. A 2-hour siesta provided him with enough time to rush home, get a quick lunch, and then pound away at the typewriter until rushing back to the clinic. Once the article was published, things on that front quieted down for several years, punctuated with occasional speaking engagements. Lester settled into work at CIA headquarters and was the associate editor at Dialogue from 1977, when it moved to Virginia, to 1984, when it moved to Salt Lake City. I believe that was the most gratifying, exhilarating, and happy period of his life. It was just an exciting time. Lester was prolific. That boy was just grinding stuff out every time he turned around. He was a man with his hair on fire in the 1970s and 80s. He published 2 articles in 1976, 1 in 77, 1 in 78, 5 in 79, and 10 more between 1981 and 1998. He was active in the church well into the 80s. It was his being asked to write Health and Medicine Among the Latter-day Saints, a book commissioned by religious historian Martin Marty, that seemed to break him down. He had so much going on at work, and health and medicine required a very specific format that was not his normal way of writing. The book took him 10 years and just about killed him, or at least seemed to take the stuffing out of him. To complicate matters, just as Lester accepted the commission to write the book, Elder Mark Peterson and the Quorum of the Twelve initiated what became known as the witch hunt that attempted to intimidate LDS scholars. Peterson compiled a list of people who he considered problems, and those people were being named and dispatched if possible. I remember Lester getting that call to say that Bill Marriott, president of the Washington, D.C. stake, wanted to speak to him. He hung up the phone. It clearly was anxiety-provoking for him. He fasted and prayed for ability to be able to converse in a way that was not confrontational. Lester told me afterwards that President Marriott was open and willing to let him go through his findings in detail. The meeting was very friendly, and there were no repercussions for Lester, unlike for others on Elder Peterson's list. Furthermore, during these 10 years of concentrating on the book and an exhausting full-time job, church activity became less and less and increasingly uncomfortable. Ironically, I believe that if he had been welcomed and given a calling, he would have made it work with all his might and mind. But no one ever asked him. Only later did we find out why. Shortly before we moved to California, I went out to our bishop for a temple recommend. He asked, "How long has it been since your husband was disfellowshipped?" This was 2017. I gasped and answered, "He has never been disfellowshipped. That confuses me." He said, "Oh, that's just what was general knowledge and was handed down." This just broke my heart. It was not right for Lester to be blackballed on rumor, and nobody took the time to check it out until that particular bishop. The bishop subsequently came by and talked with Lester. They talked and talked, and he came by more than once to get to know him. He asked Lester if he'd be willing to teach some Eldam's Quorum thing, but by then Lester, sadly, was not able to entertain such an offering. It now generated too much anxiety as he was experiencing the effects of moderate dementia. If it had only been 25 years earlier, that would have been great. Starting in 2000 until 2015, when Greg asked for his collaboration in writing a dialogue article on the gerontocracy of the future of Mormonism, there was a seemingly unaccountable break in Lester's research and writing. This was puzzling to me until I realized he was very much knee-deep in his projects. He could hardly wait to finally retire from the agency so he could work on his and my family histories. In his usual obsessive-compulsive way, he didn't wait. Efforts to access library materials and historical societies and take field trips got seriously underway by year 2000, only interrupted by world events such as 9/11 and its aftermath. Furthermore, upon retirement from the CIA in 2005, he convinced himself and the agency, with all the resources he had available to him at the agency and a good working knowledge of the medical department over the past 30 years, perhaps he could come back as a contractor and write the history of the Department of Medical Services, a history from which he said he would have greatly benefited as director. It should only take a year or two. 10 years later, after exhaustive work, he finished an 8-volume history that began with the Office of Strategic Services, which was the predecessor to the Central Intelligence Agency, and extended through the 1990s. You can be sure it had more footnotes than narrative. Only one of the 8 volumes is unclassified and is titled The Fighting Doctors of the Office of Strategic Services. Backing up a bit, the mid-1990s to 2015 were incredibly intense, demanding, and challenging years for Lester and the family. Life happens. Church presented an additional ongoing moral challenge as he worried there was a chance of unintentionally confusing people or even damaging someone's testimony now that the church had moved on. Fortunately, there were extraordinary bright spots that subsequently brought light back to his life and healed wounds that had been open for decades. The first was in 2015, when Lester was invited to give the Sterling McMurrin Lecture at the University of Utah. This is a prestigious endowed annual lecture. At first, he hesitated to accept the honor since he had been away from the field for so many years. He said, "I just don't know if it's right, whether I should do this." I would say, "You can do this. It's a true honor, and it will be a good thing for you to do." As it turned out, he was so pleased that after all these years, Rip Van Winkle awoke, and he found that his work was acknowledged as relevant. We had dinner with Marlon Jensen and Greg Prince prior to that lecture, the lecture that evening. In my diary, I wrote of the dinner, you're getting this from both perspectives now, that it was singular and profound. Elder Jensen could not have been more affirming. The effect on Lester was truly visible, and the lecture was wonderful. This was the first time Lester and Darius Gray had ever met, a truly historic event. The morning after the lecture, Lester and Greg had breakfast with Elder Jeffrey Holland. My diary note said, breakfast with Elder Holland, confirming beyond any expectation, more healing. The breakfast was on Friday. The next evening, Lester and I walked around Temple Square, retracing the steps from the night before we were married. That's when Lester said, maybe this was my mission. Maybe this is why I was meant to do this work. This brought all the goodness back together. He knew he had done a good thing. He hadn't destroyed anything. He was a good person, a person of integrity, and a true heart. That was just a beautiful moment for me. I truly believe that it was for him as well. Another bright spot occurred 3 years later when Lester and Greg traveled together to the 40th anniversary celebration of the 1978 revelation. The morning prior to the celebration, they went to the church library, which Lester had never visited. Upon hearing that Lester was in the building, Elder Stephen Snow, who is the church historian, came down from his office. This is a very historic moment, and we've all seen this from different angles. To spend several glorious minutes with Lester, letting him know how great his contribution to the church had been, how grateful he was personally to have had the privilege of meeting with Lester. Even though Lester was now visibly suffering with dementia, this meeting with Elder Snow, I believe, gave him a sweet and moving send-off that would abide in his soul forever. He was able to recall this moment with obvious excited joy to anyone and everyone who would listen for many weeks. And I dare say, he still feels and remembers even now. The healing was complete. Being able to look back over the past 50 plus years of the journey with Lester has been a gift to me and has given me even more appreciation for his dedication to truth and his mission. He never once expressed bitterness or regret, nor lost sight of his faith or the support and encouragement of his fellow scholars and devoted friends.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.